Hello, and welcome back to the Zen Embodiment channel, these bare bones conversations with myself, Corey Hess. This is episode 11 with Mark Morris. Welcome, Mark.
Hello, hi, Corey.
Mark is an illustrator, a professional illustrator, and he's been around the Zen world for a long time and spent some time at Sogenji and Tahoma. And I kind of like to think of Zen as it's kind of training to become kind of artists of life. And part of why I wanted to bring Mark on today was to show a flavor of that, how perhaps Zen opened up some doors for him that helped him to express himself and continue to help him express himself and then to dialogue with. And Mark did some really cool illustrations of the Mumon Kan years ago here. And so anyway, I wanted to show the kind of flavor of Mark as an artist and Zen person. And so anyway, welcome, Mark.
Yeah.
Hey, Corey. Hello.
So can you tell me how you got interested in Zen in the beginning, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two really good stories, my favorite stories. The first one for me, so I left right after high school, 1991. I enlisted in the Coast Guard. And I went from an area in Southern California, not too far from Palm Springs, to Kodiak, Alaska. So it was this explosive shift in like everything, which I think has a lot to do with like, if I was to talk about Sogenji, there's a similar tangent there. So I was very, I don't know, very young when I went to the Kodiak. Anyway, so one of the, at the same time that I arrived, another guy, showed up too, named Carl, and he would eventually become a ship's cook as our time went there. But he gave me a copy of the Tao Te Ching, which for me at that time was just, I'd never, ever, ever seen anything like that. Like it was, I almost think of it also while in the Coast Guard, it was the first time I'd ever had a kiwi fruit. And that was one of those other times where I was just like, you know, the world explodes in rainbows because you're like, you never, anyway. So the Tao Te Ching had that kind of quality of like this something that I had never even realized was a way to ponder things. And at the same time, you know, while in the Coast Guard, I was on a ship and I would spend 4 to 8 hours of my day on watches or at the helm. And there, it really introduced kind of a meditative state in my life, you know, that I'd never participated in. And at the time, I wasn't even really aware that I was engaging with that, but it sort of set me up to be aware of what that might look like. And so that book was really, it was like, that shifted something. But at the time, I had no idea what that would be. After getting out of the Coast Guard, I was sort of in between things. I decided to go to art school in Seattle, but I had a few months before that was going to happen. And so I decided to do an extended trip on the Pacific Crest Trail. And it was my first kind of adventure on the Pacific Crest Trail. And it was a 6-week trip that I took that would come into my life again at later points. But while on that trip, I was trying to think of how to describe this to you, but I don't know, like as time goes by and how our memories kind of become mythology, you know, and the people in that mythology, and almost, there's a great book, The Alchemist. And in the book, the main character encounters these different individuals and they each almost have like the sort of, like they were pulled from a tarot card deck or something, you know, mythological figures. Anyway, so on this particular afternoon, I was in Southern Oregon on this bluff, kind of a large hill. And I met a guy hiking south, and he was this big, and again, this is like my memory. This is quite a while ago now, but in my mind, he was sort of this Neil Young looking Boy Scout, all decked out in like 1950s camping gear. He was probably in his late 40s. I'm in my young 20s. And so we meet on this bluff, and he was just this super vicarious, like just started right away, was like engaging with me. And he wanted to know where to buy macaroni and cheese, you know, the next resupply to the south of me. And so, and he went on this great story about whenever him and his wife would not see eye to eye, he would take these long walks. And so he would just go for a long walk. Anyways, so he just had this really like, and it was actually quite short, maybe just like a 10 minute conversation about where he might find food next to the south and what he had seen as I was heading north. Anyways, but the whole time he was just like energized. So then we part ways and we're about 20 feet apart from each other. And he says, "Hey," and I turn around and he says, "Have you ever read the Dharma Bums?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you gotta read it because it's what we are." And then he turns around and walks away. So that I just, you know, at the time I was like, okay, I'll make note to read the Dharma Bums. So I finished my trip on the Pacific Crest Trail and I moved to Seattle to start attending art school. And a few months into that, I pick up the Dharma Bums.
Yeah.
And that just like between the Tao Te Ching and the Dharma Bums, I was just like off and running. Art school proved a little, I signed up for art school without a really clear vision of what I was hoping to get out of that. And about 6 months into it, I realized I had not been accurate in my choice to attend art school. And while I was sort of trying to figure that out, this interest in Zen was growing. I visited a very prominent and historical Seattle Buddhist temple, but it wasn't quite not Zen. And I had a fun conversation with one of the individuals there, telling him about the Dharma. Yeah. Dharma. And anyways, he recommended a Zen sitting group that was being led by Tony Fairbanks.
Right.
And so I started sitting with Tony's group. And a few months into that, a monk comes back from Sogenji named Rinzan. And I'm like, holy smokes, like you can actually go do this. and he gives me an address to Sogenji. And so I send a letter to Chisan about with an interest in seeing what that's all about. And she said, "Yes, if you can get here, come." So I quit art school. I worked for about, 9 months just to save up money and buy a plane ticket. And then that took me to Sogenji. Anyways, there's a really fun, like in terms of looking back on a series of events, those are kind of my favorite moments that led me to.
Love it.
And of course I was sitting with Tony. I got, I was introduced to George. Got to know Rinzan a little bit better. Tahoma was starting to happen, and I actually was able to attend the groundbreaking ceremony, I believe it was 1996, at Tahoma. And that was it. You know, I had my experience on the Pacific Crest Trail, so I had backpacking gear. And with the groundbreaking ceremony, I didn't really know anybody except for Tony and Rinzan, and had briefly met George. And so I go to Whidbey. I took the ferry, got a bus, from the bus walked to the Tahoma, not knowing anything, with a backpack, thinking I was just gonna camp out somewhere, you know. It's funny when I look back on it, I just kind of really no idea what I was doing. But was really blown away by the people I met at that event, and ended up camping out for the night along one of the main paths that would eventually develop on the property where people, you know, walk the property grounds. And anyways, so yeah, that's kind of all got started for me. Yeah.
Right. And then you made the haul to Japan, to Sogenji.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, I don't know. I was trying to, before, like leading up to this, I was trying to figure out how to encapsulate that. But I was totally blown away, you know, just absolutely. My time there was short. It was 3 months that I was there. It was just, I don't know. It's super hard. I guess it's easy for me to understand why it keeps fueling my creative endeavors. I think much like, you know, say going from Southern California to Kodiak, or eating the first kiwi fruit, like getting on a plane. And I'd never done a session before. I'd only sat like on evening sits, you know, at I had really no idea what I was, you know, aside from like books I found at the library, or I really had no idea what I was getting myself into. Yes. That was just super, super powerful. The getting off the plane, I remember I'd taken some Japanese classes, language classes prior to leaving. So I was far from being able to communicate, but I at least was able to figure out how to get a taxi to Sogenji. And I remember when the taxi driver pulled up to the main gates and it was evening time. I kind of want to say it was not rainy, but just sort of drizzly. And I remember the taxi driver turned around and he just was like, "Are you sure is this really like, really? Like, I could drive you anywhere, but you want to come here?" And I was just, the look on his face, I was just, I remember that really distinctly. And then, you know, walking into Sogenji, there was dogs started to bark. Yeah. And it was the kind of the closing of the day. So I could hear monks chanting, you know, somewhere in the distance. And I'm like, I have no idea where to go. So I'm just kind of following that noise. It was incredible.
Right. And such a, such a full on place, and such a, weird, strange, intense place, you know, gosh. And yeah, you walk in and it's like both really quiet, and then you hear the chanting and it's so, strange and powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And there was, when I got to, following the chanting, I was outside, it was the kitchen area. Didn't know what to do. So I just kind of, I maybe had like, you know, 15, 20 minutes just standing there listening to chanting, not sure what to do next. I figured I'd just, you know, wait to introduce myself until the chanting stopped. Just standing there like, what the heck am I doing? You know what? But all of that at the same time, I think was super, I think the moment I walked into Sogenji, I was sort of like a sponge that was just sort of like, you know, absorbing everything and taking it all in. Sogenji was my only experience of Japan, really. Like I flew directly there. I went to Sogenji. Encounters I had outside of Sogenji were just sort of the brief excursions that might happen,
right?
So in a very powerful way, like the architecture and the art and, you know, this 300-year-old Zen temple and all of its surroundings and right. smells and visual information,
right?
I think I was just absorbing everything,
for many of us, it just, something about it just takes hold, and somehow, so you left, but there was still some thread of that probably in your life, and you ended up at some point going and living at Tahoma, right? Mm-hmm. And you would work during the day and then live there. What was that transition like? That was,
I leave Sogenji,
yeah.
It's kind of a funny story. So it was really wild. I woke up 3 months in and I just knew it was time to go. And it's weird. I keep looking, you know, over the years since, I always look back on it and try to wonder, like, piece together, like, where my brain was at that moment. So it was this strange combination of, like I've never, I don't know, it's hard to describe a similar, like, a metaphor for it, but to be someplace that felt so appropriate, but then also get this, like, really clear message, it's just, it's time to go. Yeah. And I really, almost in a magical way, too, like, this morning I was thinking about, like, when I woke up and I realized, like, it was time to go, it was like somebody handed me, like, a ticket and said, okay, so turn left here, you know, when you come to the gate. Anyways, so I woke up that morning, and I was working at the, taking care of the guest house. Okay. So I was, my sleeping arrangements were up at the guest house. I left, so I went to Sanzen. I still never, like, it's so hard to know, like, what's happening with Sanzen, but that felt like walking into Sanzen, knowing I was leaving, was like, I don't know, that felt like a good, it felt not that I was, you know, the Roshi didn't congratulate me for anything, but it just felt like it was a solid, like, boom. And so I walk out, and after Sanzen, everybody would normally head to the Zendo. So instead of going right, I went left to the guest house. And I knew at the time, like, I knew I just, if I had a conversation with anybody, I would have paused. And I just knew I didn't want to have a conversation with anybody. So I put my things together from the guest house and then headed to the airport. And so the best part of this, the best part is I get to the airport. And of course I have a plane ticket that's meant for a later date, but I explain that I'd like to try and head out that day. And they say, okay, we'll figure something out, you know, go have a seat. So I sit down by myself in an airport, and like 5 minutes later, this big troop of Korean monks, like, just like camp out right now. And they stayed there for probably like, I don't know, an hour and a half or something. Just like, you know, I was just this, it was so great. And so I just sat there with these, you know, surrounded by monks as I wait for my trip back to Seattle.
Yes.
So yeah, no, I definitely left with like the seed of something stirred up or planted, and it definitely didn't go away. And that eventually led me to want to take one more look at it at Tahoma.
Yeah.
And so that would have been about 2002. Okay. Yusan was there leading it for a time, and then eventually that'd be Taigon would become the head monk. And I had some debts, reasons that I needed to work. And so I was able to make an arrangement where I was living on the monastery grounds. I would attend the morning Zazen and evening Zazen, but then during the day would head out to work. And so, yeah, I was in a really wonderful way. It allowed me to sort of not only take that another look at what I had experienced at Sogenji, but also maybe broaden, like kind of sort of stitch myself into the deeper or the broader relationships of, you know, One Drop and Tahoma and Sogenji, and, you know, in a really wonderful way. you know, all the individuals that I encountered throughout that year have continued to be really strong relationships years since. You know, Enso House was just getting started and moved there the year I was there. There was just a lot of wonderful, really great interactions. and then on a side story to that, I had postponed a relationship I'd been in to go to Tahoma. And I decided when it was the year was up that I was ready and lucky enough to return to that relationship. And so Angie and I got married about a month after I left Tahoma. And we got married on Whidbey with a huge support from the community. And and it's continued, and in a really neat way, I think for both Angie and I have allowed us to enjoy those relationships in the time since, and that's in a really great way.
Love it. I think of Mark as a really interesting artist, you know, that so you sort of figured out a way to explore some of your spirituality through your art, it feels like, with with this Mumonkan. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Angie and I get married, we have our first daughter, and we move to the country, and we build two yurts. And so as a family, we're living in these yurts, and I just was ready to have the just wanted to live in yurts and live in the country. But that's, it's still challenging having kids, and there's yurts, it's just putting all the pieces together can be really complicated when it comes to livelihood and career and income and all that. Anyway, so I was working as a substitute school custodian.
That's right.
Which I really loved. I actually think about that all the time as like a job I really, really loved. But the substitute part made it this scenario where like my income would fluctuate. So on one particular bad stretch, I had just called Anne just for the desire to have a conversation with her, not requesting anything. After talking to Anne, she calls back and she says, George and I are coming out. We're just gonna treat you guys to dinner. And so George and Anne arrive. It might've been the day later. I'm not sure how soon it was after that. But they bring a bunch of groceries, and we put together a really nice dinner and have a wonderful get together. And at the end of the dinner, George is looking around and he sees all these pieces of artwork. And I've been, at the time, I was like very unstructured in making artwork. It was just very like a lot of randomness and things I was kind of gravitating towards, but without any sense of structure. And so at the time I'd been playing a lot with paper mache. I was making these paper mache figures. The ones I was making had nothing to do, in terms of any literal connection to Zen or anything. And so George says, well, how much time does it take you to make that? And what's involved with it? And he liked them. And he said, well, I'd like you to make me three pieces of artwork. And he gets out a checkbook and he writes a check and he hands it to me. And it's a whole lot more money than I'd ever seen for artwork that I'd ever made. And I said, okay, I'll make three pieces of artwork. And so I make George two pieces of these like paper mache figures that I get to him. And so, but I have a third one and I'm trying to figure out like what that third piece of artwork was gonna be. And there was an upcoming event at Enso House where I was gonna see George. So I wanted to let George know that I hadn't forgotten about my agreement to get him some artwork. And so I sketched a little drawing of Nansen holding a cat with a cleaver from Nansen's cat. And so I sketched this little drawing. I said, George, I'm still working on the third piece of artwork. I haven't forgot. And so I give him that note at this event. And George really loved the Nansen cat. He's like, this is really cool. That got me thinking. And so I said, well, what if my third piece of artwork was sort of a bigger, like maybe it's more than one piece of art. Maybe it's a whole set of drawings of the Mumonkan. Maybe that's my last piece of artwork to George. And so that's what I started doing, is just going from, Joshu's Mu and just working my way forward. it just, everything clicked. I would describe it like, imagine if you're trying to hotwire a sports car. And so you've been trying and trying and trying and connecting wires, and all of a sudden you get it right, and it's like the car just like revs up, and that's what the gateless gate, you know, was for me. Was
great. Yeah. Great. Let me just backtrack real quick. So I want to just be clear here. Ann Kutcher is the director of Enso House, which is the hospice center connected to Tahoma One Drop, and that's who he's referring to. Ann Kutcher. Who we love so much. And then George is George Mosley, who is a big supporter and student of Shoto Harada, and also trained with Kobori Roshi in the 70s in Japan. Very sort of godfather of Zen. He's a beloved figure to us. And then can you talk about actually what the Mumonkan is? You know, can you just say just a little bit so the readers can understand what that is?
Let's see, the Mumonkan is a compilation of Zen koans that are, there's other compilations out there, others exist, but the Gateless Gate is, and it could be, that's also could be translated as the Gateless Barrier, but I kind of like Gateless Gate kind of rolls off the tongue nicely. Anyway, so it's a compilation of Zen koans, koans being a mode of practice for Rinzai Zen monks in monasteries, in which they're asked to dedicate a lot of time towards really crazy stories in ways that I'm still never quite sure I've never quite figured out like what that's about. But there's a compilation, these compilation of stories. There's 48. Maybe 49. I think it's 48 plus there's like a 49 like that's tagged on the end as like an extra. And each of the stories are just these really wonderful, paradoxical, contradictory series of stories. You know, monks, it's an individual encountering another individual most often. It's a teacher and student. Sometimes it might be a monk who's walking down a road and he encounters, you know, a villager or, there's a rich series of interactions, but in general, it's people encountering another person and sort of a challenge that comes about out of that. They're really short. You know, they tend to be like a koan might be no longer than a paragraph. Sometimes they can get like Hyakujo's Fox is quite long, but in general they're pretty short and sweet, and they often leave you hanging. Like you just don't know, you don't maybe get a resolution out of it, and so you're left with a question. And often, like I really love, there's like a koan is sort of like tipping point where you have somebody going through their day, and then this thing jars them, and now they're kind of like disoriented and they don't know what to do. And then you're kind of, that's where the story leaves you, you know. And then along with the koans themselves, most compilations come with a commentary. And that depending on the translation you get or how old it is, often a compilation will include a commentary from more than one individual, or so that can change. And you know, in terms of creative work, the thing was wonderful for me is, at least as a starting point, is they just provide these really wonderful like nuggets of a story, right. Which I would compare. So say like, if you sat down to illustrate Moby Dick, like it's so broad and there's so like it, you could easily get, or I would easily get overwhelmed in like that goal. Where a koan, like if you just start with Joshu's Mu and you're like, okay, what's a picture that would like represent that moment? Like it's very digestible and I can like do that. And what I found is as I started working is I would tackle that moment and then be on to this next one. And then as I'd open this next story, I'd be like, oh wow, this is another great there's really fun things happening here, or really dramatic things, or really in terms of as an illustrator and somebody trying to convey a point of a story visually, there's a lot of really fun starting points.
And I mean, just speaking from my own, you know, experience with Cohen, there's something to interact with. You know, you're interacting with them, and often in the midst of doing them, you sort of get inside of the patriarch's head. You know, I can get into Joshu's mind, and so I think it's really interesting, you know, to do drawings and illustrations. It's really interesting to sort of with your body to physically, you know, interact with them. I think it's really interesting.
Oh, for sure. The Gate is almost like Sesame Street to me. Like, you know, the especially dedicating that much time is like, it's almost felt like I was, at least in my imagination, like I was getting to know these individuals and having sympathy for this monk. And actually too, in a wonderful way, like I had owned a copy of The Gateless Gate for years prior to this art project and never really been able to figure out how you would just read it. you know, like for me, I couldn't do that. But as soon as I was able to attach the art project to it, suddenly, like I not only read the whole thing, but I was like deeply involved with each of the koans as I moved through them in a way where, you know, especially at the time that I was working on that project, they were just constantly moving through my brain.
Yelling at you, baby.
I never realized that power of artwork as just sort of a way to, I don't know, familiarize or to live within the subject matter.
Almost feel it? Could you almost channel this kind of feeling through you?
I think, let's see. So the one thing I was thinking of mentioning for this is, I think we've had conversations about playfulness and the playful activity of practice or creative effort or, and one thing I really got out of my time with the Momonkan was just this, like, this spirit of playfulness, of like a playfulness slash inquiry slash experimentation. And, you know, as I dedicated the time towards creating the artwork, that's what seemed to rise up the most, to be most prominent, you know, was just that, which is in a wonderful way correlates really nicely to art making. And so for me, like the Momonkan became all these like characters being creatively playful in all these like random moments. And then, and I felt like I could see that, or I felt like that's what it was like, what it was. If there was like a, you know, a final message to me from the Gateless Gate, it was that kind of playful behavior with art.
Love it, love it. Cool. Love it. And then you kept going now, and you're doing a lot of interesting things still. You're doing a lot of a printmaking now, and then carving. You started working with some stuff inspired by Enku, is that right?
Yeah. Let's see. A lot happened. I was in my sports car, you know. I was driving a stolen sports car, so I was like weaving around, and it wasn't very pretty. I wasn't driving it very well. But getting started with the Gateless Gate got a lot of things rolling. It opened up the opportunity to illustrate a children's book. This was the story of Mu, written by James Cordova. And you know, like this was like, this really came out of the, so as I was working on the Gateless Gate illustrations, I was sharing that artwork online, really created like this kind of opportunity. So that was super exciting in terms of like next steps.
stuff, or what was it? Tricycle or what was it?
Wisdom.
But you did some stuff for the magazine, right?
Bodhidharma. Sort of spot art illustrations for Bodhidharma magazine, or Lion's Roar, I think it is now.
Yeah, awesome.
And that all came about, you know, just from sharing what I got started with the Gateless Gate. And of course, like, for all my interest in artwork sort of leading up to the Gateless Gate, I still wasn't so much of a practiced artist, or I had not had a regiment of like education or learning. And also just wasn't, like, at the time when I started the Gateless Gate, I was just depicting the stories as best I could with the skill sets I had at the time. And especially with the commitment to getting something to George, it was just like, in a really wonderful way, I just accepted the fact that this is as good as it's gonna be.
Right.
And it needs to get done, so, which I think is actually has become a powerful tool, or a powerful example of how to be productive in my efforts. And so as I've progressed, there's been a lot of experimentation of just what mediums do I like to work with, or, you know, like I continued to play with paper mache with like darumas, and there's been,
Here's mine in my office.
Yeah.
Everyone, when they come to my office.
No, it's
my 40th birthday.
I have this little monk.
Right.
Like, is my office teacher. Just exploring all sorts of different ways to make artwork, and that eventually in its most recent incarnation has been a focus on block printing, and which is just a medium I found I really just love for a lot of different reasons. And especially as I, I grew up surrounded by a lot of popular culture, had a lot of art inspiration came from comic books. And so one of my favorite side roads in the last couple of years was a series of comic books that I self-published called Narrow Road, which actually was inspired by Hyakujo's fox. One of the main characters is a fox who's he's a monk, but he's a fox, but he's the monk that was kind of cursed to live out, you know, the, I forget how many kalpas or lifetimes it was. But and his companion is a frog, and so they travel across Japan, encountering Japanese yokai. And one thing I can credit with Sogenji is, you know, aside from like introducing me so strongly to Zen, but just sort of the, you know, to go around a corner and see, like, you know, a piece of artwork that was potentially hundreds of years old, or just these like, it's hard to encapsulate it, but it just gave me this wonderful dose of an experience in Japan that I've been able to sort of funnel towards all these other points of interest or exploration. So say for instance, Japanese yokai, which are Japanese creatures, like folklore creatures and monsters or fairies. It's been amazing to see like how just that sort of experience at Sogenji also works well at fueling all these other interests in a super fun way.
Yes.
Anyways.
It just seems like, you know, the idea, you know, we can, you know, follow our passions, you know, and that we can, keep pursuing them, and then they evolve, and then they inform us more, and then we dialogue more with that. And it just seems like that's what you've done. You know, you followed your real interest, and you and it grew, and then it blossomed, and then it got you like a job, you know, yeah. And then a profession, and then you became a freelance, artist too. And it's just so cool to, you know, just for the artist out there to, you know, to see, well, I can follow my passions and my interests, and they can, they really can, you know, become something really, you know, beautiful. It works for my life. It's pretty awesome, you know?
No, for sure. And it's a wonderful way to like, for me, it's become a really wonderful way to sort of relate to all the memories and encounters of my past. So for instance, like a comic book about Zen monk frog and fox hunting yokai, like it's a way for me to touch on, you know, the 15-year-old me drawing comics, you know, and then, but then I attach that to Zen, and suddenly, like, in terms of like the personal history story, like it's a way to look back and kind of fortify certain things, look back on other things, digest certain things. And it's just been this fun, like, kind of sorting process, but using the artwork to kind of like, as an avenue to make that happen. And it continues to like, I mean, I'm still, in terms of artwork, it very much rooted in what I encountered with Zen. And I don't think I've come across, at least something personally for me, a kind of muse that provides so much to work with. Like, it just, and I mean, The Gateless Gate is one book, you know, and there's other compilations of koans, and there's hundreds of other stories, and there's just, you know, there's stories that come from China and Japan, and there's, you know, the world of Zen and Buddhism is so fascinating and broad to me, and provides so many starting points for creative efforts in at least so many wonderful ways, that it's just, it hasn't yet. So say the Gateless Gate drawing started in 2010. So I've had a 10-year stretch where it can, you know, it's just been like this solid push forward in a really wonderful way. And I have started carving as my, my fingers. This one almost required stitches. I had, you know, the Christmas story where they're like, you'll shoot your eye out. This was my you'll shoot your eye out carving band-aid. But anyway, I have been, let's see, where's doing these little carvings, kind of looking at Enku as like a point of inspiration. I'm really excited about, actually, this afternoon, I'm gonna start, you can sort of see this sitting figure.
Nice.
Taking shape out of this one.
That's cedar.
What's that?
Is that cedar?
Yeah. And it, we had these old cedar fence posts, and so I was looking for sort of a nice soft wood to practice with. And by cutting down these cedar posts, I've been able to pull out some really beautiful pieces of wood. We're gonna see how carving goes.
Awesome.
But
wonderful. Anything else before we depart? Any last words?
No, I just for me, the encounter with everybody from Sogenji to Tatoma to everything in between, like, it's just such a, it's been very wonderful. Like, I don't know. It's interesting, like, what Zen is like, in terms of Zen practice, like, that's always felt very elusive for me. Like carving something out of wood, it's a bit more concrete. Like, I can be like, okay, I'm gonna follow these steps, and if it looks like a seated Buddha figure when I'm done, then I'm okay. But then, like, you sit and you're like, it's elusive for me. I've always found it super challenging. I continue to get prompted to keep exploring that. Like, there's something that says, probably good for you, go do that. But I've never quite known, like, what been able to convey, like, what that is.
Yes. Yeah.
But at the same time, like when I look at the history that that participation has kind of fostered in my life, it's just something I'm incredibly grateful for and really appreciative of. And you know, there's something that happened among all that that has been, it's been awesome. So
love it, wonderful. Well, hugs to the girls and to Angie, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
From me and from my family. And thanks so much, Mark, for joining me today. And I will put links to your website in the show notes or whatever. And anyway, thank you so much. Really great to have you here. And I think people will be will really get something out of it. And these artists out there exploring, I think it's really cool to get to see this, what you've done with your work and how it sort of has fit into your life. That's really cool. So anyway, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Corey.
Okay, cool. All right, I'll see you later.
Okay,
cool.